From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The New York Times recently published a major expose of the inner workings of the social media company Facebook over the past several years. The investigative piece revealed that Facebook executives Sheryl Sandberg and founder Mark Zuckerberg made major missteps in the years after the 2016 election revealed that its user data had been misused. According to the Times, bent on growth, the pair ignored warning signs and then sought to conceal them from public view. At critical moments over the last 3 years, they were distracted by personal projects and passed off security and policy decisions to subordinates, according to current and former executives. Even worse, the Times found that Facebook employed a Republican opposition research firm to discredit activist protesters, in part by linking them to the liberal financier George Soros. The report was based on interviews with more than 50 people. Groups like Color of Change, which were among those targeted, denounced the social media platform's actions as reprehensible and dangerous and said that Facebook, quote, should be ashamed. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan, director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of Information Studies and Design and Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. His latest book, co-authored with Adam Fish, is called After the Internet. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
Hey, Sonali. Very nice to be back with you.
So This interesting piece by the New York Times has come after Facebook has been in the crosshairs of politicians and lawmakers. Zuckerberg famously testified in front of Congress and had to defend the way in which his outlet has been used, and, you know, he has allowed it to be used in our political sphere. Were you surprised that Facebook, you know, run by Jewish Americans, would hire a PR firm that essentially used an anti-Semitic tactic to discredit its critics?
Right. I mean, I think what we have here are a bunch of sort of competing motivations. And at the end of the day, the choices that Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg have made are very clear. They are focused on Facebook's bottom line. And they're focused on ensuring that Facebook maintains its now 2.2 billion person user base. And so if you notice in the past, choices have been made or statements have been made supporting maintaining Holocaust denier content on Facebook. And those are choices that were made explicitly by Mark Zuckerberg under sort of freedom of speech types of justifications. You know, despite their own personal identity as Jewish people, it's quite clear that as business leaders, Facebook is making choices that are focused, again, on the technology maintaining its centrality in all of our lives. And it's a very convenient and very popular, sadly, excuse that's used these days. To blame almost anything that is problematic on people of color, on minorities, and on Jewish people. And, you know, we see that happening with the sort of redirecting of blame at the hands of George Soros and other folks like that, you know, who are targets of hatred, targets of mail bombs, literally, by the fringe on the right in this country and in this world. And now we're at a moment that is pretty unprecedented in recent decades where the fringe right, the racist right, is now emboldened to have a great amount of voice and political power, partly thanks to the presidency.
Right. This tactic by this PR firm, it's called Definers Public Affairs, and it was actually founded by Republican operatives. This particular institution essentially helped push a narrative that those organizations critiquing Facebook were being bankrolled by Soros and his Open Society foundations. This is exactly the approach that Donald Trump and Donald Trump's supporters have taken to discredit the left. In fact, Trump, in the wake of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and the protests around it, basically said that these protesters were paid for by Soros. And Facebook and hiring this company is essentially using the same tactics as Trump and his racist supporters. They should have known this was going to come out eventually.
Maybe they should have, but it's quite clear that their interests are completely focused on keeping everybody happy with them, and they will go to almost any moral or ethical lengths, it seems, to maintain that. So we see them coddling their longtime friend, Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the United States Senate, on the one hand, to sort of maintain mainstream kind of liberal credibility or mainstream democratic credibility. I wouldn't even say liberal. But on the same at the same time, we see them playing to populist right wing, sort of lines that frame everything as a Jewish conspiracy, frame it as a conspiracy of, migrants and pseudo caravans that are invading our country. The conspiracy. So we have to get back to the real core issue here, which is the platform, and we can speak about how that occurred, but the platform upon which so-called fake news proliferated and became the norm and became the information that really informed people in the United States and around the world about political content is perfect for the company to put fake news onto themselves, right? So there is no better company for popularizing fake news themselves than the company on whose platform fake news proliferated, right? So there's something very sad but true about this situation, and it speaks to the amorality, not the immorality inherently, but the amorality, the absence of a clear ethical compass outside of maintaining credibility and therefore users. 2.2 billion users we're talking about around the world.
Well, you say amorality, but it almost seems, at least to those of us on the left, that Facebook has tilted toward the right when it comes to, not when it comes to relationships with politicians like Chuck Schumer, but when it comes to whose content is allowed to remain on Facebook. You mentioned that Facebook has essentially allowed anti-Semitic content under the guise of protecting free speech, and yet activists that are with groups affiliated with Black Lives Matter have found that Facebook has routinely censored their pages whenever they post stuff that's critical of police. It can tend to, at least anecdotal evidence points that Facebook will remove it, saying that it's violated the community guidelines. And that's one of the ways in which Color of Change, the organization I mentioned earlier, had gotten involved with Facebook, because the live stream of the young Black mother in Washington State, Corinne Gaines, was removed from Facebook, her account shut down by Facebook at the request of police, who were, who essentially surrounded her home and then killed her. And Facebook was taken to task by groups like Color of Change. And yet Zuckerberg put up a banner saying Black Lives Matter on the Facebook campus. Where do you think all of these stories show the, Facebook's position is on the equality of Black people in America?
Right. I mean, I think I really hear what you're saying, and I completely agree that it's not just amorality. It's whatever it takes to maintain what it is that creates profit for Facebook. So in terms of public perception, Facebook would never want to be, as it now has been exposed, aligned with anti-Black interests, anti-civil rights interests, anti-Black Lives Matter interests. However, it also does not want to be aligned with honestly, xenophobic and racist interests, insofar as those interests translate to any sort of threat to their user base. And I want to get at why, in my mind, at least a theory I have on why it is that these sort of fringe right-wing stories are so welcome on Facebook. And we're finding not just welcome in terms of how the technology operates, but welcome in terms of being explicitly solicited by the company itself, right? In terms of who they hire. And the reason why is there's a great amount of sensational, attention-grabbing, jaw-dropping, hysteria-inducing, spectacle-based content that is produced out of the fringe of the right that is now sort of the new normal in our political discourse in this country. And that works for Facebook. Why is that? It gets our attention, just like Trump gets our attention, right? It gets our attention. If our attention is grabbed, Facebook has exactly what it wants, because the more attention it gets, the more data it gets, the more it can persuade us and take us down all sorts of dysfunctional yet addictive rabbit holes.
Interestingly enough, at this very time that you and I are talking, a story of the police killing of the brother of a Facebook executive in Northern California has been in the news. The killing actually took place a while ago, but an African-American man, actually I'm not sure if he was African-American, but he was certainly black. He might have been an immigrant, not yet a citizen, not quite sure yet. Chinedu Okobi, the brother of Facebook executive Ebele Okobi, was brutally murdered by police, and she just got the chance to review the footage, the police footage of his killing. And what she described sounds like a straightforward police execution, by multiple police officers. Horrible, horrible story. And she's speaking out. She wants justice for her brother. And one wonders if groups like Black Lives Matter or other activists were to post or repost Ebele Okobi's, justifiably angry post about her brother's police killing, whether Facebook would find that violated community standards.
Right. Facebook wants to shy away from controversy if that controversy doesn't grab your attention. And this could grab their attention, but it's very important, it seems, right? As we're finding out, every day we're finding out a little bit more from this bombshell that broke through the New York Times, that Facebook is very, very interested in maintaining its centrality in the lives of right-wing and white users in this country. And it gives me the sense that, when you look at the world and you look at who has power in the world institutionally, politically, and so on, you see Facebook taking sides with the powerful. And that's not just something that we see in the United States. That's something we saw in Myanmar with Facebook banning multiple Rohingya, right? The Muslim minority. They were banning Facebook groups that were pro-Rohingya, even created by Rohingya people themselves, while they were endorsing Facebook groups that were created by the Burmese military that was enacting a genocide. We see the same thing happening in the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte and his so-called cyber troop foot soldiers. We see the same thing happening on WhatsApp, which is a platform that Facebook owns. Remember, Facebook owns WhatsApp, owns Instagram, with Narendra Modi in India, with Bolsonaro in Brazil. So the pattern is again and again, right-wing hateful interests are welcome as long as they accomplish the output for which Facebook as a company and therefore its technological design are optimized, which is keeping you into the hysteria zone, keeping you into the shock and awe zone. It's also, the effects of this are politically, and I would say on a deeper level, ethically and on a spiritual level, disastrous. They're disastrous on us because they keep us in hysterical silos. They misinform us and literally at times intentionally disinform us. And that's what we see happening here with Facebook, they want to play to all sides, and in so doing, they ultimately play to their side, which is how do we keep you glued to dysfunctional content?
Right. And just a quick clarification, Chinedu Okobi was a Nigerian-American, and he was killed by police in San Mateo County. It was the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office. So, interestingly enough, there's news on the day you and I are talking, which is Monday, that Facebook is going to be spending a lot of money in the UK to train journalists. This is a really interesting piece that essentially shows that Facebook is thinks that it needs to train journalists. When I saw this story, I thought to myself, isn't it journalists that should be training Facebook?
Thank you. That's exactly that's what I was going to say. Thank you. That's again, Facebook wants to be the platform for everything we do. Our experiences of the social world, inclusive of news and political information. They want to be the public space, but they're not publicly accountable. So that includes encapsulating and basically capturing all journalistic content. You know, when I interviewed Noam Chomsky for my new book, and I talked to him about manufacturing consent, right? This 30-year-old critique of how news stories are sourced to reflect the interests of the powerful. Chomsky made the point that those interests have not changed, but at least these folks are journalists, meaning that they have some attempt. They're not just pundits and analysts, so-called analysts like Sean Hannity, just talkers. They're actually trying to gather information and present some sort of logical, rational form toward things. What Facebook does is it takes the already closed ecosystem of journalistic content that you get even on the New York Times, and it winnows it down even further. It silos it further. And the reason why it silos is it keeps your attention. By keeping your attention, it can actually expose you to an even narrower window into news information that's out there. So I think a lot of these sorts of moves, like hiring local journalists, are PR moves. I think that they also are seen as a low-risk investment and low-cost investment that can allow Facebook to be seen as the local town crier as well, the local zine, right? And what you have to note, whenever you see big tech companies, and this is something I'm making the point in my new book, including Google, you know, setting up AI labs, artificial intelligence labs, all across, you know, multiple labs on the continent of Africa, is their goal is to present the world to you always on their platform. And remember, and this is an important point that was not stated very visibly with this latest New York Times story, people who have never created an account with Facebook ever before, right? Say you and I never created an account. We never had any interest, Sonali. It's not like we once created an account and we got off the platform. If you never created an account, you are still being tracked by Facebook. And those are called registered non-users. In what sense are you registered if you've never created an account? Are you registered to surveillance? That's what you're registered to.
How do they even find people who haven't used Facebook? I mean, just from any other internet use? They're buying data from Google or something?
Tracking analytics software is on almost all of our web browsers, and it's on our mobile phones, more importantly. So even if you don't have the app installed, there is tracking software that's connected to other sorts of platforms. Might even be somehow connected to the iOS. There's a real lack of clarity and transparency and disclosure around those issues.
And of course, Facebook's goal, I imagine, is to ultimately convert all those non-users into users.
And you're something of a user, even if you're being tracked, you're still providing data that provides value to this private interest. Remember, private company masquerading as public space. So wants to benefit from public from public engagement, but doesn't want to be publicly accountable, right? So there's this kind of very interesting bait and switch in terms of framing and branding that I think is a big part of this as well. And I can't emphasize it enough. You also have to look at what we call the political economy of these companies. Who do they own? How, you know, sort of vertically integrated are those organizations? And so again, if you have Instagram, if you have WhatsApp, you have, you know, other like goggles and wearables, The question is if you look at the overall portfolio of ownership for Facebook as a company, much as you might do the same for Alphabet, which is like the Google holding company, you can see something far more ubiquitous. You know, it's essentially an enclosure on your life, right? And a digital enclosure.
Now, one of the big reasons why Facebook has been making news for how it functions is, of course, the 2016 presidential election that I mentioned. We just had a major election, the midterm elections, and going into those midterm elections, there were a lot of concern that Facebook would essentially allow itself to be used or misused ahead of that election, like it did ahead of the presidential election. When the Cambridge Analytica, the British PR firm, essentially used Facebook to target, micro-target voters. As far as you know, how did Facebook do this election?
Yeah, so the way Facebook is set up as an architecture whereby third parties can gather data from Facebook-installed applications. So, you know, we all heard about the Cambridge Analytica saga, which I actually had contact with Cambridge Analytica before the story broke, because I was trying to just kind of describe what they were all about before. Mm. It's very important to know that Cambridge Analytica worked all over the world with many different governments, dozens, in fact, not just right-leaning, but also left-leaning at times, or even centrist in various parts of the world. They also worked for the Ted Cruz campaign before they worked for Trump. In fact, they worked for the Ted Cruz campaign for a much longer period of time. And how do organizations like this that are interested in micro-targeting users with psychologically influential content, how do they function? Well, the key is they gather data on their users on Facebook itself. How do they do that? Well, they have little games. There are little games you can play, like Candy Crush Saga. In this case, it was called My Personality Quiz. And what we all did was decide to play that game and post that information and laugh about it with our friends on Facebook. I don't think either you or I did it, Sonali, but I'm not sure. And what that quiz in this particular case was actually created by a man named Alexander Kogan, who worked with Cambridge Analytica and provided the data of the users who used that quiz. But the key point is that's not enough to get that much data. They also got the data of all of the friends of those users who played that game. And so this is all seen as a feature of Facebook's platform. Remember, what we see politically or publicly or socially as flaws or threats to social welfare or democracy or cohesion and tolerance and love are actually features of the platform. The platform is set up to allow for micro-targeting. And the key secret sauce, if you will, about Cambridge Analytica, though it's not been proven that they really had a major influence on the election outcome, but the key feature was they were able to map data that they gathered through Facebook, one. Two is they purchased a great amount of data. Hundreds of millions of Americans can have their data purchased about them through their credit card records, through other sorts of records as well. We are leaking data everywhere we go, thanks to these mobile phones, through what are called digital footprints. And they're bringing those data streams together, the Facebook data and the digital footprints, and comparing them to fine-tuned psychological models, what they call psychometric models of people. So it's not like Ramesh is 40 years old and Indian American and lives in this part of Los Angeles. It's that Ramesh is neurotic in these ways, in relation to these people at these times of the day, open in these ways, agreeable in these other ways. These are fine-tuned models that are linking psychological identities, of which we have many, with all these digital footprints that are brought together. So, you know, who I present myself as on Facebook, or maybe you also, Sonali, is different, than who I am when I'm buying things with a credit card, right? Those are different forms of my identity, but if you can bring all those different trails together, you can really, really target and manipulate people. And you can even influence them to not vote, which is what we see some evidence of related to Hillary Clinton supporters dating back to 2016, with targeted super predator type content reaching black voters based on their psychology. That's the key.
That is all very terrifying. Ramesh, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really like how you've emphasized constantly about the issue that Facebook is acting like a public sphere, but with no public accountability. And that's something we have to keep reminding ourselves. Thank you, as always. I appreciate it. I know we'll have you back on again in the future.
I can't wait. Thank you, Sonali. Hope you have a great day.
You too. Ramesh Srinivasan is director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at UCLA. His books include Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World, and the book co-authored with Adam Fish called After the Internet. We've been discussing the recent news around Facebook. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali. Charlie.